From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen continues its Year of Darwin celebration with an interview with Dr. Marlene Zook from the University of California at Riverside about the impact of disease on human evolution.
I'm John Sterling, editor-in-chief of Gen. Welcome to our fifth installment devoted to our celebration of the Year of Darwin. Dr. Marlene Zook is a professor in the Department of Biology at the University of California in Riverside. Her research focuses on evolution and behavior, with a special interest in the evolution of host-parasite interactions in the context of sexual behavior. Dr. Zook, as we continue to celebrate the 200th birthday of Charles Darwin and the publication of his Origin of Species 150 years ago, what do you consider Darwin's main contributions to science in general and to biology in particular?
Probably know, Theodosia Stepjansky, who was a well-known geneticist in the early part of the 20th century, said that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of the study of evolution, which has become a cliche, but really is true. I think what Darwin did is give us a framework for thinking about almost everything that has to do with life itself. Where did species come from? Why are there so many different kinds of organisms? How do they change through time? How are they related to each other? And so with that framework, people can address a lot of different questions that persist, you know, today. And one of the things that I'm really struck by, because of course we've all biologists are doing a lot of reflecting about evolution this year since it's such an important year, as you say, one of the things that really strikes me is how timely his work still is, that despite knowing nothing, of course, about genetics, knowing nothing about cell structure, know about a lot of the mechanisms that we take for granted now, he really came up with a powerful tool for understanding biological diversity.
You're an evolutionary biologist, and much of your work focuses on the study of parasites. What role or roles have parasites played in the evolution of Homo sapiens?
In my book, which is about evolution and parasites and disease, I tell people that it's sort of a happy book about disease. And I mean that only partly tongue-in-cheek, because I think that the role that parasites have played, people always think about this and they think, oh, no, you know, we've had diseases and plagues and horrible things and people get sick. And it's certainly true that parasites have played the role in terms of making people sick, and that, you know, yes, that's not a good thing. It reduces mortality. It, you know, makes us feel bad and so forth. But at the same time, we have evolved through our entire history, as have all other living organisms, with various pathogens and parasites. And so they've shaped the way we are, for better or worse. And I think that recognizing that helps us take a little bit more, maybe, okay, maybe not a happier viewpoint, but perhaps a little bit more interested one than just immediately having that kind of gloom and doom, what I refer to as the Ebola's coming, we're all going to die books. There's a little bit broader perspective that you can take from an evolutionary standpoint.
One chapter in your book, and the book's entitled Riddled with Life, addresses the idea that sex evolved as a way of adapting to parasites. Please talk about this in more detail.
See, sex is a perfect example of the way that parasites and pathogens have shaped who we are. One of the things I always ask my students, and I teach a class in animal behavior, and I say, okay, what's the most important question you can think of about sex? And they all eye each other uneasily because they're not sure what I'm actually after. But what I am after is that the most important question about sex is, why does it exist? In other words, why, instead of just reproducing ourselves clonally, or, you know, dividing like bacteria, or, you know, undergoing some other asexual mode of reproduction, why do we go to all this bother of having two separate sexes, which then have to combine their genetic material to produce an offspring that's only half like each of the parents? And the reason this is a problem from an evolutionary perspective is that if selection is all about passing on your genes, you're going to pass on a greater proportion of your genes by cloning yourself. And, you know, that's a very simple thought experiment. You know, imagine an organism, as some organisms do, imagine an organism that's reproducing asexually. It's going to pass on twice as many copies of its genes if it does that than an organism that has to undergo meiosis and, you know, have half of its genes combined with the genes of another individual. So what's the big advantage for sex? Well, right now, one of the best answers that we have is that pressure from biotic forces like parasites and pathogens has driven the constant need for changing our genetic makeup so that your offspring are different from you, their offspring are different from them and different from you and so forth. What all this genetic diversity does is not just, you know, give us people that look different or organisms that look different. It gives us an ability to outrun our co-evolutionary arms race with our parasites.
Why are males what you call the sicker sex?
So that's related to this, too. So what happens is that I do have a chapter that I must say a lot of men have not appreciated called the sicker sex, and the sicker sex really is male. Although if you think about it, it's very obvious that that's true. If you go into a nursing home, you know, there's lots more old women than there are old men. If you look at sources of mortality for humans in any culture and at any time in history, men always die sooner and are more susceptible to a variety of diseases than women are. I mean, there's a couple of exceptions, but by and large, men seem to have immune systems that are a little bit more vulnerable to disease, and they just die from a lot of sources of mortality. As an evolutionary biologist, I'm going to interpret that as part of what we call a reproductive strategy. So males, and this is not just true for people, but for animals in general, males by and large benefit by having what you might call a living hard, dying young strategy, where they compete a lot for access to females, but in so doing, they risk being vulnerable to a lot of sources of mortality. Females, on the other hand, are going to optimize their reproduction by being in it for the long haul. And to understand why that's true, just think a little bit about who's going to be able to have more offspring, male or female, in their own lifetime. Females are limited by the number of offspring they can produce and rear because, by definition, they're the sex that does that. And so if you think about humans, you know, how many babies could a woman have in her life? I mean, well, we're starting to push the boundaries, of course, with Octomom, but by and large, you know, like, what, 20-something, 30-something, and probably not all of those are going to live. In contrast, think about how many offspring a man could have. I do this with my class, too, and there's always that little silence again. They look at each other, and then they start giggling, you know, because obviously there isn't any obvious physiological limit on male reproductive success. It's just a matter of how many women he can get to be fertilized, you know, by him and bear his children. So that difference means that males tend to emphasize competition and beating the other guys to the females, whereas women are going to be in it for the long haul. Those evolutionary differences, in turn, seem to have also resulted in selection for men to, you know, if they can win big and that means they're going to die early, that's still going to be selected for, and they're still going to evolve that way.
An extremely fascinating topic in your book is how parasites and the diseases they cause can influence the behavior of people. Could you give us some examples?
Sure. So people have often thought about their parasites as, you know, creatures that just kind of live passively in them, sucking out energy but not really doing very much. The thing is that you have to think about this from a parasite's point of view. If the parasite can be transmitted more easily by altering something about its host, then, of course, selection is going to act to produce a parasite that does that. And if one of those things that makes the parasite transmitted more easily has to do with behavior, then it's going to do that. Let me first give you an example in animals, and then we'll consider whether that could happen in people or not. In a lot of animals, rodents, for example, will get toxoplasma, the parasite that is transmitted to predators like cats and so forth. That's the reason that you tell pregnant women not to clean the cat box and to stay away from that because you don't want them to get toxoplasma. Well, one of the natural hosts is a rodent like a mouse or a rat. If the mouse or rat gets eaten by a cat, then it completes the life cycle of the parasite. So it's good for the parasite if the mouse or rat gets eaten. Of course, it's not so good for the mouse or rat. But what these parasites seem to be able to do is alter the brain chemistry of the rodent host so that it's less afraid of cats or other predators and hence is more likely to be eaten. So the behavior of the host is actually manipulated by the parasite that it harbors. People don't seem to have anything quite that clear, but we are affected by toxoplasma, and there's some interesting, at least preliminary evidence, that suggests that, for example, people who are infected with toxoplasma, because it does go into humans, although obviously we're not naturally preyed upon by cats, But people who are infected by toxoplasma tend to get into more car accidents. So they tend to be hit by cars more often, even as pedestrians, which the scientists that did the study suggested is because they're taking more risks. I'm not sure I'm going to get behind that 100%, but it's certainly an intriguing idea.
You also make the point that disease is not merely ubiquitous, but normal. Can you elaborate on that?
I know that disease is not something that people like a lot. No one wants to get sick. No one gets up in the morning and says, yay, you know, maybe I'm going to get a cold today. But I think that this evolutionary perspective makes you understand that things have always gotten sick. They always have, and I would venture to guess they always will. We have evolved from the very beginning with other organisms that are living in and on us. And, in fact, the line between pathogens and commensals and things that are downright beneficial is not always all that clear. I'm sure everybody's heard the data on how many different kinds of bacteria and other microorganisms there are living in and around a human body. Some estimates put it at a 10-to-1 ratio of the microbes to our own human cells if you look at all of the bacteria in the digestive system and so forth. And so the idea that we're going to naturally have lots of different kinds of organisms living on and in and around us is becoming increasingly accepted. So it's not just that, oh my God, you know, and again, this goes back to the Ebola's coming, we're all going to die mentality that I think we need to work against, that it's not that, being sick is an unusual or odd state. It may not be good, but it's normal.
Another theme that runs through your book is that many of us live in an overly organic, hygienic environment, which can actually make us sick. Why is this the case?
Well, because of exactly what I just said. So we get sick, obviously we get sick if we're infected with an infectious agent, but it's not just that simple. That because we evolved with this milieu of microorganisms and other types of parasites and pathogens, if you attempt to remove them too strenuously, your body's immune system, in effect, I mean, this is anthropomorphic, but, you know, in effect doesn't know how to behave, and it can misfire. Current thinking is that at least some autoimmune diseases like lupus or Crohn's disease, some of the inflammatory bowel disorders, as well as allergies and asthma and eczema, are related to not the presence of things like toxins or pollutants, but potentially to the absence of normal immune stimulants when people are very young. So that if babies in particular are not exposed to a variety of immune stimulants, their immune systems don't develop normally, and they're likely to get these diseases. So we have this whole host of diseases that physicians refer to as diseases of the advantaged, which are diseases you only see in Western industrialized societies where everybody has become hypervigilant about, you know, cleaning everything up and using antibacterial agents and putting antibiotics in cattle feed and so on and so forth. That this is stripping our environment of a natural component.
In your book, you have a chapter entitled "Why Doctors Need Darwin," which explores the concept of Darwinian medicine. What are the major principles of Darwinian medicine, and why would doctors be wise to incorporate these principles into their daily practice?
Well, I'm not sure that all doctors are going to be thinking about Darwin every time they see a patient with a cold or someone who's got an certain, broken leg. But I think there's two principles that are useful, again, as sort of an overarching framework. One of them is this idea that I've been alluding to all along, which is that you need to look at disease not just as something that is happening passively, but that as an interaction between two living things, as an ecological relationship, just the way we'd look at, deer being eaten by wolves. We need to look at hosts and their parasites. That then means that some of the outcomes of a disease, what we call symptoms, could be due to the parasite getting an edge and being transmitted better, like the wolf being able to, run faster or have sharper teeth. Or some of the symptoms could also be things that the host is doing to get rid of the effects of the parasite, like the deer being able to be camouflaged better in the forest or something like that. A great example of that is fever, which, of course, is an accompaniment to lots of different infectious diseases. Parents of small children in particular tend to get really upset when their children have a fever. They want to treat the child because the child seems uncomfortable and give the child, some kind of medication to bring the fever down. In fact, evidence suggests that fevers are not something that's being done by the pathogen to increase its transmission, but instead is a response on the part of the host, namely the kid, to decrease the effects of the pathogen. And so if you allow children to have a fever, in fact, they'll get over at least some diseases more quickly than if you try to decrease the fever or minimize it with medication. So it's a somewhat more, ecological way of looking at disease. And so, you know, increasingly I think pediatricians are recognizing that they want to discourage parents from giving their children fever reducers unless there's some specific reason to do so. The other big principle is an idea about mismatch, and this suggests that our bodies evolve under certain circumstances, and we've now changed those circumstances, and our bodies haven't quite caught up. Like, you know, the fact that we didn't used to have readily available sources of high-fat and high-sugar foods, and so in our evolutionary history, it was a good thing to go out of your way to eat sweets or go out of your way to get very fatty foods because you could use them as energy, you could store the fat, and then when it was famine, you know, you'd be in better shape. Now, of course, we've kind of got an endless supply of high-fat, high-sugar foods, and it's not so great seeking them out and craving them all the time, and hence we've got, you know, epidemics of obesity and diabetes.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus, saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.